He pursued other goals too, but he and his masters in Washington, Moscow, Tel Aviv, and Europe didn't reach any of their goals. In this episode, we are going to talk about Basij Volunteer Forces, with a focus on Imam Khomeini's view on this popular organization. Stay tuned, please. The 8-year war was imposed on the Islamic Republic of Iran only 19 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. In other words, Iran's army had not yet reorganized itself after the changes that had occurred during the revolution. In such conditions, the greatest hope for standing against the Iraqi invasion was the revolutionary fervor and martyrdom seeking of the young generation to defend the country and the revolution. The youth of Khorramshahr, with this very morale, showed very stiff resistance against several Iraqi divisions for 35 days, although they had the least possible weapons and had not received any military training. The Iranian youth had reached the belief that they had to defend their country and revolution only with trust in God and reliance on their abilities. This self-belief and self-reliance showed their effect after the war in the form of social, scientific, technological, and economic progresses. The Iranian people understood in the war that they must stand on their own feet. As Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, put it, "In this war, we reached the belief that we can struggle against all powers and superpowers for long years." He also said, "In this war, we broke the awe of the two powers of the East and the West." The Iranian nation was personified during the 8-year war in the shape of Basij forces. It means that creative youth with self-belief and self-reliance proved they can make progress without dependence on big powers. This characteristic of the Basij forces made both friends and enemies praise them. The economic sanctions forced the people to find new ways of meeting their needs via abandoning consumerism and trying to manufacture the products that they needed. This was while, before the Islamic Revolution, Iran's industry was based on montage and that under the control and supervision of foreign advisors. Imam Khomeini said, "This war, the economic sanction and expulsion of foreign experts, was a divine gift that we were negligent of." The founder of the Islamic Republic had said elsewhere, "Do not expect that somebody will help you from abroad in reaching the goal, which is Islam and putting its laws in practice. You should rise up for this vital affair, which will materialize your freedom and independence." One of the very foresighted acts of Imam Khomeini was give the main role in the war to the people. He ordered the formation of an organization called Basij-e-Mustaz'afan, in English meaning Mobilization of Volunteer Forces of the Oppressed. What is interesting is that he made it clear that the country with 20 million youths should have 20 million Basij forces. Due to his profound awareness on the basic goals of the enemy to topple the system and revolution, Imam Khomeini understood that the Iranian nation, just like the days of the revolution, should get united against the invading enemy. This strategy had a very deep impact on victories in the battlefield. Thus, the idea of popular mobilization, that is Basij, paved the way for demonstration of creativities and initiatives. Imam Khomeini described Basij with very beautiful and lofty expressions. He said, May God's mercy and blessings be unto the passage, which is truly the support of the Islamic Revolution, and has continued its precious endeavor and, thank God, has trained million-strong volunteers with the effort of thriving youth. It is hoped that, with the active participation of the nation's great strata and the zeal and joy that is seen among the dear youth with the blessing of Islam, the 20 million-strong army will materialize, which will be the guardian of the Islamic Republic and the dear country against the aggressive world devourers. In the view of Imam Khomeini, a Basiji is not only the one who has taken part in this organization or institution as an official member. Rather, all the downtrodden and oppressed nations and groups in the world are Basiji. The Imam said, "Let the powers, the superpowers and their stooges be sure that if Khomeini is left alone, he will continue his way, that is the way of a struggle against disbelief, oppression, polytheism and idolatry. And with God's help, alongside the Basijis of the Islamic world, these barefooted who are under the wrath of dictators will seize comfortable sleep from the eyes of the world devourers who insist on their oppression." The Imam also said, "In this world, I am boastful that I am a Basiji myself." A brief survey of the eight-year war reveals that, had there not been the Basij, Iran would have never triumphed over Saddam, who enjoyed the all-out support of scores of governments. Basij showed a new role model for the oppressed and downtrodden in the world to fight against oppressors, too, for their rights. Supreme Leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "The greatest achievement of Imam Khomeini was to train Basiji youth."
Iran Today.
Patriotism and piety, courage and resistance. These are attributes associated with Qasem Soleimani at home. But even Americans and Israelis would, in describing how he was a thorn in their sides, find themselves complimenting him. He was assassinated by America in Iraq on January the 3rd, 2020. Soleimani has been called master of Iran's intrigue by Americans, and by a prominent Israeli, he has been described as a commander who knew how to exploit the secret infrastructure he had established in order to fight, win, and establish presence. The Israeli in question would be Tamir Pardo, a former head of Israel's Mossad intelligence service. Pardo is relating how the fight against ISIS or Daesh turned Major General Soleimani from a shadow figure into a major player in the geopolitics of the region. And there it is. The main reason behind Qasem Soleimani's overwhelming popularity at home and inspirational legacy across Iran's borders. His fight against the nightmare terror group Daesh or ISIS. This is not to say everyone liked him equally, but he was loved by fellow combatants and revered overboard as a soldier who evolved into so much more on the battlefield and at home as a person. For a closer look at the man on the anniversary of his assassination, stay with me, Leila Faramayzi, on Iran Today. Soleimani the man can be seen even in his image as a soldier. He is known to have prevented both praise by the combatants and also the formation of boss-subordinate relationships. In other words, he was an egalitarian while at the same time commanding and winning battles matched to the world's superpower. That is why I will begin with his military legacy and move on to the more personal. We visited Resalat paper for a chat with Mr. Ambar Louis on the life and legacy of Soleimani, who was martyred along with 9 others, including Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Muhandis was deputy commander of Hashd al-Shaabi, that's the popular mobilization forces, PMF, of Iraq.
Who was it that destroyed ISIS in Syria and Iraq, which the Americans said would last 20 years in a short time? Well, it's a fact that the people of the world know, but they want to know who was the creator of this power and what his ideas were. And it's important that Qasem Soleimani is currently at the top of the world news.
Soleimani, a youngster with no more than a high school diploma, joined the front during the imposed Iraq-Iran war of the 1980s. He rose quickly in the ranks and in 1998 he became the longest-serving head of Quds Force. Quds Force is the IRGC's extraterritorial operations arm. Being an IRGC commander was not cause for popularity, but his selfless courage on the battlefront and his tactical military mind applied to complex geostrategic situations in the field were.
He didn't need to study at military universities and colleges. He gained his experience in the field. He had been on the field for 40 years, fighting and gaining experience, and at the same time using his own mental faculties and the inspirations he received. And so you see in the television footage that a military general who has reached the rank of lieutenant general saying his prayers in ordinary clothes. You see how he draws the operational lines without even carrying a handgun. When you look at American troops and generals, they're armed to the teeth with the most cutting-edge weapons and military equipment. He was an ordinary soldier and did not need any decorations. His thoughts and beliefs were his decorations.
Iranian and Iranian-backed forces became major combatants against Daesh after that terror group took over roughly a third of Iraq in 2014. The conflict went on till 2017 and was a rare occasion that put Iran and the US together in their fight against Daesh. That is not to say it was an equal fight. Iran was fighting for the safety and stability of its neighborhood, West Asia or the Middle East. But the US was the entity that birthed or supported groups like Daesh and the Taliban, only to fight them partially, to keep them in check and rearrange them for future use. Anyhow, 3 years disgraced by the dirt spewed by Daesh over the birthplace of prophets did see a collaboration of sorts even between sworn enemies. On a number of occasions, Americans were hitting Daesh targets from the air, while at the same time, General Soleimani was directing ground forces against them. That's the Quds Force and PMF on the ground. Soleimani was a natural-born leader, deducing from all one reads and hears. He was always in to fight for a cause and grouped people to go along with him. He was instrumental in preventing Iraq from completely falling to Daesh by fighting with his Quds Force and Iranian-backed Iraqi militia forces and regular forces. Kurdish leaders have been cited that when Daesh took Mosul in 2014 and was about to head for Erbil, there was no American or Turkish support in sight for the Kurdish forces. But in just 2 hours, Soleimani arrived in Erbil with 2 large planes of military supplies. His presence alone was a battle shipment. He shored up the frontline Peshmerga soldiers to protect Erbil and Kirkuk from the Daesh onslaught. And protected they were. Mr. Sharif is a fellow general who knew Qasem Soleimani on the job. He has plenty to say on the person and his assignments.
Qasem Soleimani, as Jarian Qasem Soleimani used the death of Jalal Talabani in such an appropriate way to create unity in the Kurdish society. His visits to such areas always carried an immense amount of risks. But as you know, he went there and offered his condolences to Talabani's family and even paid a visit to his grave. With this behavior, the emotional relationship and the diplomatic and political dialogue, he prevented great bloodshed in this region, and the Kurdish region remained as part of Iraq.
Also in the south of Iraq, where that country's forces had collapsed with Daesh at the gates in Baghdad and Najaf, Soleimani organized Shia militias with a fatwa from Ayatollah Sistani. And he conducted his commands to the effect needed in pushing back Daesh. And pushed back Daesh was. Otherwise, America would have met with a very different scene in Iraq when in 2003 it invaded that country to oust its Ba'athist president Saddam Hussein. In ousting Saddam, America pushed Iran away from itself yet further as well.
In the southern part of Iraq, you can almost see the same situation. But when you look at it, on the Iraq issue, Saudi Arabia was one of the countries experiencing the worst failures. This is the result of Haj Qasem's strategy in employing and paying attention to all tribal sheikhs in Iraq, and not just Shias. When you look at his discourse, relations and behaviors, they have pervaded all Iraqi societies. Such behaviors ruled out a conflict with the Kurds in southern Iraq. Haj Qasem's behavior throughout his life has been a unifying factor.
With the 2003 invasion, Iran's allegations of U.S. meddling in other states' affairs were yet again justified. And as the United States sought to negotiate a deal for Iraq to allow American forces to stay in the country past the 2011 deadline, General Soleimani advised Iraqi officials to refuse to sign. His quiet charisma and pragmatism were winning traits in convincing parties and rallying their support. American officials even have been known to try to communicate with General Soleimani to ease tensions in Iraq.
You see, if you remember, during the invasion of Iraq, the United States disarmed all Iraq's artillery and missiles, bought off all the military leaders of the Ba'ath Party, and then carried out its attacks. The policy of the United States and Europe in conquering governments and territories is to buy off and deceive their leaders in negotiations, either through offering bribes or issuing threats. He was the one who closed the door to dialogue with the United States, but that's not to say that he did it every instance. We have had interactions in Afghanistan and even in Iraq, but he had shut the door to negotiations with the intent to buy him off.
There's plenty been said on the matter and the man in different voices and media outlets. Let's take a look at some of those sources with Shahsa.
Hi, I'm Sharza Manateri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on the anniversary of the cowardly assassination of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis by the U.S. TASNIM news agency reports General Soleimani thwarted U.S. plot to change region's identity, Nouri al-Maliki says. The former Iraqi Prime Minister and current Secretary General of the Islamic Dawab Party said the U.S. decided to assassinate Soleimani because he thwarted many of its plots to change the identity of the region. Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis succeeded in stopping more than one scheme for changing the region, which bothered the Americans a lot. He added, Qasem Soleimani helped the people in fronts in Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq to withstand and become strong in the face of the aggression, and perhaps his position in Syria is the most prominent, where he stopped the plot of its collapse, which was prepared by Israel and Arab countries. ABNA 24 claims massive rally planned in Baghdad on anniversary of martyrdom of General Soleimani al-Muhandis. a massive rally is planned to be held in the Iraqi capital of Baghdad on the first anniversary of the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Now, a year after the assassinations, various programs are planned to be held in Iraq to commemorate the martyrs. According to PMU official Abu Zia al-Saqir, the programs will be organized at the popular and official levels. They include memorial services in different cities, he noted, adding that a million-strong rally is also planned in Baghdad, in which the participants will call for the expulsion of U.S. troops from the Arab country. In an article by Tehran Times, we witness Iran bent on avenging Soleimani's assassination to prevent further U.S. terror attacks. Ali Shamkhani, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, says Iran is determined to take tough revenge against the U.S. for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani in order to prevent the continuation of their terrorist attacks. The Islamic Republic of Iran is determined to take tough revenge on the perpetrators of this historic crime, prevent the continuation of America's terrorist destabilizing acts, and force them to leave the region, Shamkhani said. Shamkhani said the U.S. exit from the region will pave the way for sustainable peace and security. He said the U.S. intensified its destabilizing moves in Western Asia, which reached its peak with assassination of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in terrorist attack at Baghdad Airport. That's all for this segment.
Soleimani was no doubt a military genius. He managed to shatter Israel's image of invincibility. That happened during the 33-day war of Tammuz in 2006 between the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah and Israel on the other side. The war was part of George W. Bush's plan to destroy the resistance in Palestine and Lebanon and topple the government in Syria after having invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. It was all part of a broader plan intended to finally isolate and encircle Iran, who went to Beirut in the early days of the Israeli attack on Lebanon was Qasem Soleimani. He did so to organize the resistance forces and coordinate combat operations.
Hello.
Now the world's strategists are assessing who was he who prevented Syria's Bashar al-Assad from being toppled, even when the whole world had gathered to do so. More importantly, they want to know who was he who somehow participated in commanding and managing the wars in Lebanon and Gaza. While Israel defeated the armies of four or five Arab countries in 1967, how did he manage to come out as the victor in subsequent wars against the regime to the point that Israel is now besieged by Lebanon and Gaza? Who was it that changed Lebanon's Hezbollah position from being a deterrent to a group that takes preventive action?
Thanks to Soleimani and the troops he commanded or joined forces with, Daesh was defeated in, yes, Iraq and most parts of Syria. A less popular fight worldwide, however, was that in support of the Syrian government. But it has been successful all the same. Mr. Kanani Mogaddam is a veteran of the revolution with experience on all fronts. Always worth an interview.
From the very beginning, General Soleimani identified and strengthened the cause of resistance in our region. He separated the real resistance from mercenaries, connected them and turned them into rings of resistance. He then intertwined these rings to form a chain of resistance that stretched from the Mediterranean Sea to East Asia, from Afghanistan, Yemen, Lebanon to Palestine and Syria. And then this chain of resistance became the resistance front. With his martyrdom, the Americans thought the work was over and the chain would be broken. But we went one step further in the sense that his martyrdom created a popular social movement of resistance in the region, not only between Muslims and Shias, Sunnis, Kurds, Arabs, Persians and Afghans. Many freedom seekers around the world realized that they can stand against the Zionist regime and the United States by means of resistance.
Without strategy and pragmatism, a fight against the likes of Daesh would have been futile. Fighting Daesh has several dimensions, such as being on the front lines with Iraqi and Syrian fighters, regular and accurate command in the fight against Daesh, dealing with foreign powers and good and coordinated cooperation with Iraqi, Syrian or Russian commanders in the fight against Daesh, and foiling U.S. plans in transferring Daesh forces to operational areas by identifying front lines. This raises the question, might the U.S. have assassinated Soleimani and company just as a distraction from Donald Trump's impeachment? General Soleimani and other leaders of his generation were shaped by the eight-year war Iraq inflicted on Iran with U.S. and world support, in seeing Iran weak in its new-founded revolutionary state. It wasn't as weak as they thought. Far from it. Iran has a standing army traditionally, and volunteers as well as the forces flew and filed in zealously as they saw their borders breached. But the conflict from the Iraqi side was so cruel with trench warfare and chemical weapons that devastation has been compared to World War I. Nearly a million people died on both sides.
From a historical standpoint, we saw a young man in his 20s joining the IRGC early in the war between Iran and Iraq, who soon was prompted to command a division. You know, to command an army, one has to go through all the ranks from being a trooper all the way to the top. But in his case, a young man came in the midst of a tough military battle and became the commander of a division. This was only the beginning of his career. After the war ended, he didn't lay down his weapon. In the Quds Force, he commanded several multinational divisions.
General Soleimani spent much of that US-backed war on the front lines, determined with his comrades to see the war through as a never-again moment. So as he departed right after New Year in 2020, he left behind a legacy and will to oust U.S. forces from this region. In fact, on January the 5th, Iraq's parliament voted to expel U.S. military forces from Iraq, with parliamentarians chanting, "Yes, yes, Soleimani." Although this decision may not actually have changed the status of U.S. forces yet. I did ask. Iran reacted to the Soleimani assassination on 8th January, a day after his funeral procession. This happened by an Iranian major missile strike on Iraq's Ain al-Assad base, where American troops were stationed. So, would this not be avenging enough now that Donald Trump was not re-elected as U.S. president, so as to do much more harm, one would hope? After all, it was Trump who reportedly mulled over the idea of removing Soleimani over a game of golf, having been motivated by his Foreign Secretary Pompeo's speculations. Pompeo is known as the Trump Whisperer. Soleimani was a military tactician and diplomatic strategist who knew how to rally both militia leaders and presidents. In a former interview with a long-standing diplomat and politician, I asked something on foreign policy, and he automatically pointed to the Soleimani strategy as a reference point. He would be none other than Mr. Amir Abdullahian.
As the first slap in the face of the U.S. in the first round of measures to avenge General Soleimani's assassination, which was Iran's airstrike on the U.S. strategic base of Ain al-Assad with precision-guided ballistic missiles, at least 110 people were killed. But the Americans said they were having mere concussions. The Americans are still trying to prevent words from getting out and won't allow anyone to say that it was anything more than concussions. This revenge will not necessarily be limited to a specific method and model. This revenge that will prove bitter for the other side will bring more peace, stability, and security to the region.
Soleimani's evolution from soldier to legendary general is self-evident in what's come to pass in the program. But what of his person and personal growth?
Even inside the country, you see Qasem as independent and beyond any political orientations. This is because of his deep worldview. You must have heard his speech in which he called on politicians not to divide the country. He said, either principalist or reformist, with or without hijab, we are all Iranians and children of this country.
He منیت نداشت.
He was one of the commanders who wasn't egotistical. He never sought any attention in any missions he was assigned to, whether it ended in victory or defeat. Another characteristic he had was that he didn't act as a superior to any of his forces who fought on different fronts, whether Afghan, Iraqi, Lebanese, Palestinian, Syrian, Christian, Muslim, Zoroastrian, Yazidi, Shia, or Sunni. His behavior wasn't affected by any ethnic or tribal consideration.
Such is the legacy of a man who was present on all fronts, both external battlefields and internal natural disaster sites, such as flood-stricken areas. He was present for two-thirds of his 62 years on this earth, until a single incident and a U.S. drone strike outside a Baghdad airport targeting his car. His funeral matched his legacy. His casket, together with his companions, toured Baghdad before takeoff for Iran. And in Iran, it went from Ahvaz to Tehran, Qom, and Mashhad before being laid to rest in Kerman, where he grew up. Processions were in their millions and were not limited to Iran.
Ceremonies were held to honor the man from India, Pakistan, Yemen to all over the region and in Europe and even Latin America too. Who was this man? This man had a political and religious discourse, and according to the leader, he had his own school. Now, if we want to know what Soleimani's school says, the clearest and most well-founded document is his published will. In his will, he explained line by line his beliefs and how he reached this level. And over the past year, tapes of his speeches and lectures have gradually become available.
That's it for today. Thanks for staying with us to review a man whose legacy mattered in his life and now matters in his death. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Scientists and health bodies are calling for tighter coronavirus restrictions in England as cases continue to rise and hospitals report mounting pressure. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Nicola Davis. The piece is titled Scientists Call for Full Lockdown in England as New COVID Cases Multiply. Stay with us for more of Nicola Davis's article. Scientists and healthcare bodies are calling for tighter coronavirus restrictions in England as cases continue to rise and hospitals report mounting pressure. Issuing a warning ahead of a government review of the tier system in England on Wednesday, 30th of December, the independent Sage Group of experts said that unless the whole country was immediately put under lockdown, there could be tens of thousands of avoidable deaths. The National Health Service providers, which represented members within NHS hospitals, mental health, community and ambulance services in England, also called for Tier 4 restrictions to be further extended across the country. The calls came in the same week that the number of patients in hospitals with COVID in England surpassed the peak in the first wave, with 20,426 people in hospital with the disease on 28th of December, and numbers expected to rise further as cases climb. On Tuesday, coronavirus cases reached a new record high, with 53,135 cases reported in the United Kingdom and 47,164 cases reported in England. The seven-day average rate for London as a whole to the 24th of December was 807.6 per 100,000 population, twice that of the rate for England, whilst Thurrock in Essex had more than 1,300 cases per 100,000 population for the same period. Christina Pagel, Professor of Operational Research at University College London and a member of the Independent Sage Group, said things were as bad as they had ever been. "The frightening thing is that they are going to continue to get worse," she said. "Action is needed now to avoid the collapse of the National Health Service in a few weeks' time. It is that serious." The group warns that with the emergence of a new United Kingdom variant of the coronavirus, which is estimated to be 56% more transmissible than previous variants, the situation has taken a turn for the worse, and the current tier system is not sufficient even in places where the new variant is rare. The very rapid rises of cases in London, the southeast of England and east of England, under restrictions that previously kept growth much slower, highlights the need for a radical rethink of how we deal with COVID-19 going forward, the Independent Sage Group wrote in an emergency statement, adding, "Cases were rising, albeit more slowly, across all English regions." The Deputy Chief Executive of the National Health Service providers, Saffron Cordery, said pressures on the NHS were rising at an unsustainable rate in some parts of the country. Saffron Cordery added, "Thankfully, trusts in other areas have been helping out," she said, "but with the virus spreading fast alongside mounting winter pressures, the options are narrowing." Britain's Health Secretary Matt Hancock addressed the House of Commons on Wednesday afternoon following a Tuesday evening meeting of the government's COVID-O committee, chaired by Prime Minister Boris Johnson. With ministers under pressure to take action to stem infections amid surging coronavirus cases, some locations in the Midlands and further north could be moved into the Tier 4 system. "We urgently need to get ahead of the outbreak," said Saffron Cordery. "The COVID-19 tier review offers an opportunity to do just that. It will require difficult decisions, move millions more people to the highest level." Saffron Cordery added that while such rules will impact people's livelihoods, well-being and the economy, the cost of not taking any action will be heavy. The Independent Sage Group has called for a national lockdown and the closure of schools for at least a month for most children, along with other demands including a plan to scale up the vaccination program and tougher measures for those travelling to and from the United Kingdom. It said it was necessary because cases had continued to grow since early December in areas under Tier 2 and Tier 3 restrictions, whilst even the tighter Tier 4 restrictions introduced in areas where the new variant is common did not appear as yet to be slowing down the spread of the virus. The group said cases in current Tier 4 areas had risen fourfold since lockdown. With the incubation period for the virus lasting up to 14 days and delays in getting tests and results over the Christmas period, the impact of Tier 4 restrictions might not yet be fully apparent, but the group said the signs were concerning. It is now over 10 days since Tier 4 restrictions were imposed on London, Kent and parts of Eastern England. "If cases in these areas do not level and reduce soon, then we cannot expect Tier 4 restrictions to be enough to contain COVID-19 in England," they warned. Among the evidence to support their calls, the group point to an analysis of the spread of the new highly transmissible coronavirus variant by experts at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine released this month, which warned that even if the whole of England were placed under Tier 4 restrictions on Boxing Day until the end of January, the R value will not fall below 1. The study, yet to be peer-reviewed, also warned that without a substantial vaccine rollout and tighter regulations, the death toll of 2020 could be surpassed within the first 6 months of 2021. According to the Mirror, a White House source said, the Tier 4 rules do not appear to be working, adding that the government could introduce another level, like a Tier 5 level. Whilst no details have been released as to what such a tier could look like or whether it would even be called Tier 5, one possibility is that the tighter measures could include closing schools for most school pupils and moving education online. I can't see any other option for getting the virus under control, said Professor Susan Michie, a member of the government's COVID-19 behavioral science team that feeds into the SAGE group, as well as the independent SAGE group of experts, although she noted that she had not heard any direct evidence that the government was planning such a move. Schools closed, meanwhile, for most pupils during the first lockdown in the spring, whilst the other restrictions included the edict to venture outside only once a day for exercise, leave home only for essentials, and for all non-essential shops and places of worship to close.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues to surge across the world, many countries have started mass vaccinations in an effort to bring the virus under control. From Europe to Latin America, many nations have imported vaccines in large quantities to help their people get rid of the highly infectious disease. Iran, however, has managed to come up with its own domestically produced COVID-19 vaccine. The country has now begun testing the inoculation on humans after successfully completing the initial steps, including tests on animals and obtaining necessary approvals. The human trial of the vaccine was initiated at the headquarters of executing the order of Imam Khomeini in the capital Tehran on Tuesday. A total of 56 volunteers will gradually receive injections during the first stage. The vaccine, Coviran Barakat, is named after the pharmaceutical group behind its development. The achievement comes as Iranian authorities have been critical of the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy a vaccine from abroad. Many believe the Iranian-made vaccine proves the country's enhanced capabilities despite U.S. sanctions.
Necessity is the mother of invention, they say, and the Iranian people needed a vaccine. The U.S. Maximum pressure campaign denied them access to the vaccines. And so the Iranian people, their scientists, their government, had to go the extra mile to be resilient and develop their own domestic vaccine. It's a remarkable achievement, but it's the kind of thing that is an unintended consequence of campaigns of maximum pressure and hybrid warfare against countries. People learn to be self-sufficient, to be reliant, and they make new alliances with other countries in the military, economic, and political spheres, and that's exactly what Iran has done.
On Saturday, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani once again lashed out at Washington, saying its wicked activities have caused trouble for Tehran to acquire vaccines. Earlier this month, the head of Iran's central bank also slammed the U.S. administration for its sanctions, which he said have been hampering efforts to purchase the inoculation. Abdel Nasser Hemmati said Iran is prepared to purchase the vaccine through the World Health Organization, but it is unable to transfer the required money due to what he called inhumane U.S. sanctions. Hemmati, however, expressed hope that the vaccine-related transactions will be facilitated through other channels. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal in May 2018.
Since then, American officials have targeted every Iranian sector with sanctions ever enforced against any nation. The U.S. economic pressure has prompted Iranian officials to take a tactical step against such measures. Earlier this month, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, urged officials to focus on neutralizing the sanctions apart from securing their removal. The leader even cautioned against trusting the enemies and warned that U.S. hostilities toward Iran will not end once President Trump leaves office. But from the medical field to the military complex, technology, and a whole host of other fields, Iran has advanced its know-how domestically thanks to the U.S. maximum pressure campaign and sanctions.
Clearly, the U.S. campaign of maximum pressure has not succeeded in overturning the government of the Islamic Republic, and in fact has made it stronger and more resilient. And an unintended consequence of all of this maximum pressure campaign has been to force Iran and other countries under the thumb of the U.S. to become more self-reliant and to seek other trading arrangements, other military arrangements, other political alliances. And the end result is that the U.S. empire is now declining, and it will continue to decline at an ever-accelerating pace.
But the U.S. measures are not bound to sanctions alone. Washington and its allies, namely Israel, have a long history of using other evil tactics to prevent Tehran from its advancements. That includes the assassination of Iranian scientists, with Mohsen Fakhrizadeh being the latest victim of U.S. and Israeli plots. Fakhrizadeh is not the only Iranian scientist assassinated by the American and Israeli agents, and probably will not be the last one.
The U.S. and many of the G20 countries engage in regimes of economic sanctions and programs of hybrid warfare against a number of countries with the point of bringing these countries under their control. The U.S. is an empire, and it uses campaigns of hybrid warfare, which included, for example, the targeted assassinations of General Soleimani and the nuclear scientist Dr. Fakhrizadeh. Includes economic sanctions. It includes continuing attacks in the mainstream media. It includes lawfare initiatives against the government of Iran. And it does all this in the hope of bringing down the Iranian government.
Probably they forget the fact that the advancement of a nation does not depend on one person. Eliminating icons like Fakhrizadeh will, of course, be felt for long, but will not stop Iran from going forward. The U.S. anti-Iran moves also raise questions as who is the United States really targeting by using all possible means to block a country's progress, be it hampering efforts to buy a coronavirus vaccine or anything else.
From the very start, there was no doubt that the EU would not give the British a deal that would match any of the conditions met by being a member of the EU. So when Johnson and von der Leyen announced a deal had been struck, why then did the UK hail it as a victory? But with the details yet to be fully made public, many people are labelling the deal as a sham for the British, clearly suggesting that the EU negotiators, led by Michel Barnier, stood firm to the end and made sure that the EU did not come out the loser on the deal. According to one French source familiar with the exact details of the paper and who wished to remain anonymous, it seems that the British made huge concessions, giving up many of the terms and conditions they claimed they would fight for. However, it seems that ultimately the British team had no choice but to cave in. Several days after the deal was announced, EU and British officials and lawmakers are poring over the details. The document is rumoured to be some 1,200 pages long, but once read and digested, will demonstrate just how many concessions the UK finally gave into and reveal just exactly what Boris Johnson tried to hide on announcement day.
Brexit is a disaster, an absolute disaster, and it's one that Boris Johnson is like hugely responsible for just by himself. I mean, as a journalist, he did his very best to poison the waters between the UK and the EU. He succeeded. The the referendum passed, and now Britain is facing the reality, just a few days away, of a forcible separation from the continent.
What was clear from Johnson's announcement is that nothing new has come from the deal, with Britain claiming victory over its borders, freedom of movement, and trade criteria, all things that, with a deal or not, Britain would have had anyway. So where then does the victory lie for Whitehall? Johnson's next task is to win over the hardline Brexiteers, many of whom who wanted to leave the EU without a deal, claiming that Britain will be fine on its own. However, it seems that Johnson may have already convinced many to fall in line, as any sign of division now by the British would send a message to the world that the deal was in fact a disaster for the UK, a message that Britain can ill afford to leak out. The British made numerous promises prior to the announcement of the deal between Britain and the EU. Some of these promises included protecting the rights of British fishermen, farmers and businesses. Yet it seems, as details slowly emerge, not all are happy about the deal. British fishermen, for one, have already started claiming that they've been sold out by Boris Johnson as they face sharing British waters with EU fishermen for the next 5.5 years, only increasing their quota from 10% to 20%, suggesting that not much will change. But when it comes to the financial value of fishing in the UK, one has to really question the fishing industry culture. With fishing making up only 0.1% of the overall British GDP, is it any wonder then that Johnson failed to push hard for a fair deal, raising the question as to just what else he folded on?
There are several. There are the question of fishing rights, which apparently he had to give more ground than he wanted to. Which essentially gives the EU greater rights in the English Channel than British fishermen had wanted to grant. The other one involves business services, and that's really quite unclear as to what will happen. The agreement is 1,200 pages long, so no one at this point is quite sure what's in it.
For Johnson, and all in favour of Brexit, a long road lies ahead before the full impact of Brexit becomes clear. But what's for sure is the level of uncertainty and division that lies ahead. For a start, Scotland will no doubt seek a second independence referendum, sparking a chain reaction that will likely see the north of Ireland request to be united with the Republic of Ireland, causing a breakup of the UK, something that seems an inevitable consequence of Brexit. From the EU perspective, Britain, it seems, is a spent force, a country living in the fading memories of past glory, and slowly but surely floating further away from Europe, something that the EU, for one, will be happy to watch sinking on the horizon.
The United Arab Emirates has become a trade hub in the region, with strong links across West and South Asia and Europe. The country has, among other things, been trying to establish itself as a large and fast-growing marketplace for gold. According to data collected by the Observatory for Economic Complexity, the UAE's gold imports have increased by an average of 58% to over $27 billion in 2018. The Arab country's fondness for gold comes amid its plummeting oil reserves and the UAE's drive to diversify its economy. Gold has proven to be a lucrative commodity in the past months, particularly as investors favored the precious metal as a safe haven during the uncertainties in other markets as the coronavirus pandemic hit. The importance of gold for Dubai's economy is such that its trade volume surpassed that of diamonds, oil, jewelry, and cell phones in 2019.
The United Arab Emirates has no gold on its own, as is clear. They have oil, but they have no gold yet. Gold is their second largest export, so all of their 17.7 billion of their gold export is being imported first and washed or laundered by re-exporting it mainly through the UK into Switzerland and other gold refining places like India.
But there's another side to this story. The United Kingdom's Home Office and Treasury issued a report on money laundering and terrorist financing, labeling the UAE as vulnerable to illicit activities due to a lax policing of gold movements across the country. But how does the UAE acquire all that gold? And where does the country buy the exorbitant amount of precious metal from? According to investigations conducted by The Sentry, an NGO that tracks dirty money linked to African war criminals, 95% of gold officially exported from Central and East Africa, much of it mined in Sudan, South Sudan, the Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, ends up in the Emirates. Gold has funded armed conflicts in the region for years, but the jump in prices in the past few months has turned the metal into new blood diamonds, as it's been increasingly obtained through brutal mining practices and illicit profits, including the use of underage workers.
First, the international gold laundering is a gigantic human rights abuse, foremost because it uses many countries in Africa, in South America, are using massive child labor. Children not only are put in tremendous risks working in the mines, in narrow, rickety underground tunnels that could collapse anytime, and often do, but they are also poisoned on a daily basis by chemicals used in extracting gold from the rock.
In 2016, the UAE declared gold imports from 25 African countries worth $7.4 billion, which had not declared any exports to the UAE. The Emirates declared $3.9 billion more in gold from most of the 21 other countries it imported from than was declared in exports.
Gold laundering is an international crime because it is mostly run by mafia-type organizations, where killing and other type of violence, plus sexual abuse of women, forced prostitution, are a daily occurrence. It's actually the law of the day, you could almost say, in these illegal gold mining areas. There should be an international law enforceable, issued by the UN, if at all possible, and enforced. It must be enforced by the International Criminal Court against anything to do with gold laundering.
Gold's small size and high price make it a suitable target for smuggling, and the UAE's minimal control and regulations have turned the country into a magnet for the metal. The situation has become so dire that the London Bullion Markets Association called on Dubai and other gold hubs to conform to the regulatory standards or face a blacklisting of their exports. While the UAE has promised more transparency, only time will tell how and to what extent the country will fulfill its pledge.
The U.S. is facing another crisis thanks to the actions of the U.S. President Donald Trump. This time, it has to deal with a massive COVID-19 relief bill. Donald Trump said that he is unhappy with the massive bill, which provides $892 billion in coronavirus relief, including extending special unemployment benefits. $1.4 trillion is also needed for normal government spending. The U.S. President said that he is not signing it, in part because that one-off $600 stimulus checks for struggling Americans are not large enough.
I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000 or $4,000 for a couple.
An increase to the size of the checks was something Democrats attempted to get, but Republicans refused to accept it, throwing it further into doubt the future of any imminent financial relief for millions of struggling Americans. However, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi plans to hold a vote to approve the $2,000 checks on Monday. Another objection made by Trump was that the bill gives too much money to special interests, cultural projects, and foreign aid.
$600 for the past several months that Americans haven't received any assistance is almost nothing. It's $1.75 a day. And it's quite pathetic, especially when you look at how the rest of the bill gives millions of dollars. It gives $33 million to Juan Guaido. It gives millions of dollars to Israel to regime change measures. And this $600 essentially is going to go to landlords. It's going to go to banks. Americans are going to see that money and it will be gone in the next moment.
Trump's refusal to sign the bill is not just affecting jobless benefits. A partial government shutdown will begin on Tuesday, unless Congress can agree a stopgap government funding bill before then. The U.S. president's move surprised many, particularly since Trump left nearly all of the negotiations to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who made no push for the $2,000 stimulus checks that the U.S. president is now seeking. All through the month